Where do you find yourself most spiritual? Where do you find yourself closest to God? Right? Close your eyes for a moment and just imagine that place. How many of you are now thinking of a mountain or a beach or a green space or a wilderness, or how many of you are thinking of a city? How many of you are thinking of your default spiritual position is a built environment? And I think we are kind of, most of us in our spirituality are hardwired to think about the created order as being more spiritual than the built environment. I'm no different than that. You know, what's that? What's, is it a hymn or a poem? You're closer to God in the garden than any. But it's actually, and if you think about the way we do theology, how many of our metaphors and illustrations are pastoral, as in countrified, are to do with the country, are to do with fields, are to do with sheep, are to do with mountains, are to do, and how many of us look and think about the city as being a place of violence, darkness, sin, and you know, you don't go in there, and you don't. And so, what do we do? It shapes the way we do church. It's why we don't know the cities in our suburbs with our big churches. All, you know, almost invariably, the biggest churches are in the suburbs. Now, there's a fantastic, we could spend another hour or two or three thinking about the theology of how we do church in the suburbs and its relationship to the city. And even where there are big churches in the middle of the city, you'll find the majority of the congregation come in from the suburb. And the churches, by and large, we are suspicious of cities, we're suspicious of built environments. And yet, cities throughout the world are growing at a rate of about a million people a day. And church growth isn't going anywhere near keeping up with the growth of our cities. And so the city presents, I think, a profound missiological challenge to the church about how we do mission, about how we do church, about how we think about church and city and so on. And much of we don't have time to do it, but if we were to look at how the idea of the city develops in the scriptures, you'll see actually that it's not without good reason that we're suspicious of the city. Cain kills his brother. God curses him and says to him, what was the curse that God lays on Cain? Anybody remember? He makes him a restless wanderer on the earth. He sets that kind of mark on him to protect him as he wanders. But the consequences of killing his brother and of breaking relationship like that was that he becomes a restless wanderer on the earth. Cain's instant response to that is twofold. And the Bible says he lays with his wife and she conceives a child. And names of Enoch, and he was at that same time building the city. But I just find that really, really interesting. Two responses to wandering was to try and get rooted and having something that will be there after I go, my child. And the second thing he tries to do is to get away from the curse of God. He builds a city to settle down. So the origins of the city for Israel are in the curse of God and Cain. And you see as the story unfolds that all sorts of things emerge from the city. Stuff like culture emerges. Because cities create culture. If you are tied to the land, depending on the land, to responding to nature and the seasons and so on, you don't get a great deal of spare time. Create a city and a city living environment, and a hinterland that depends upon the city, you suddenly create space and spare time. And one of the other, and you get music, what it says in Genesis 4, you get all those aspects of culture. You also get technology. Technology happens because of the city. So guys start making machinery, which make the work of tilling the ground easier, which creates more spare time. So that when cities begin to emerge in history, the whole concept, people's concept of time begins to change. You also, when you throw people together into a city, you also get violence. And you find in the story of Lamech, which comes after Cain, that he kills somebody for insulting him. And he takes the good aspect of the city, which was the culture, the music, and he writes a song to glorify violence. So within the city you get, as we've been saying constantly over the last day or so, that city living is a mix of things. It's good and it's bad. And you move on to the story, you have someone like Nimrod, who becomes a warrior. And Nimrod uses cities to launch empire. So cities become the launch pad for war and the acquisition of land and territory. Cities in Babel, in the Tower of Babel, cities become the place. Funnily enough, when you crowd all these people together, cities ultimately become the place of non-communication. And so you have all this kind of negative stuff that emerges about cities. But one of the things that Israel had to cope with was the fact of the promised land. Now, what's the most famous way of describing the promised land? It was to be a place that flowed with milk and honey. That's one of the most well-known descriptions. And that feeds into this kind of pastoral thing we have about theology and church, flowing with milk and honey. But the promised land is also described as a place. I'll read it for you. When God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, and here is the description, a land with large, flourishing cities that you did not build. So, when it begins in violence, it begins in trying to create a refuge from the curse of wandering. So the cities is a disobedient act in its first. It's also part of the gift of the promised land. It's a gift of grace. Large and flourishing cities that you didn't build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you didn't provide, wells you didn't dig, vineyards and all of these are urban images. It's all to do with an urban economy. So what Deuteronomy is saying, that as well as the dark side of the cities, if you receive the city as a gift, it can be a gift of grace to you as well. The city is a graced space. It's got these two dimensions to it. Funny thing about Cain and Nimrod in the Old Testament is that they are both described as men who build cities. But what God wanted, and building cities to make a name for yourself, building cities to make a reputation, building cities to create empire, building cities to set yourself up, and both those men are described as doing it using words that are used of God in creation, but setting up new beginnings, but setting yourself up in opposition to God. Cities can be either that, in the place in which you set yourself up against God, or if in the promised land you receive the city as a gift, it can be the gift of grace to you. And so Deuteronomy unfolds, and this is like a lightning quick tour through this thing. Isn't it funny that Cain builds Enoch, the city of Enoch, as a refuge from wandering, an endless wanderer in the land of Nod? And the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 19, says this, for instance, when the Lord your God has destroyed the nations whose land he's given you, when you've driven them out and settled in their towns and houses, then set aside for yourselves three cities, centrally located in the land your God has given you to possess. Build roads to them, and divide them into three parts, the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, so that anyone who kills a man will flee there. Cain took it into his own hands to build a city of refuge, and God said, I don't want you to do do that? Here is the way I will provide for refuge. You centrally locate these cities, build big straight roads to them so that those who commit murder, unintentional murder, have a place to go. So far from being a very dark picture in the Old Testament of the city, it's this two-sided dimension, as every city has, two sides to every city. As the story in the Old Testament unfolds, we are presented ultimately with two cities, the city of Jerusalem and the city of Babylon. And in a sense, every city today is both the city of Jerusalem, the promised city of God, and the city of Babylon, the city of exile, the city of where you're a foreigner and native. And that's the tension we live with. And so today we're going to see things as we go through the streets. We're going to see things which will be grace space, which will be places in which human beings have deliberately fashioned something as a way of creating a kind of special place, space. Places in which I guess some of you might be blessed, even Derek might be blessed by the door on the wall. Maybe. But we'll also be going to places which are a million miles from that, which are more like the city of Cain, more like the cities of Nimrod, more like the cities that men build to escape God, as they did, rather than cities that are received as grace places. So that's by way of the Bible is from cover to cover an urban book. It's an urban book. I'm fascinated by the fact that the story begins in Genesis in a garden, not a wilderness, but in a shade-tilled, tended garden. We fall from that in Christian theology. We fall from that in the sin of Adam and Eve. And the rest of this Bible unfolds as a story of redemption and remaking the stuff. But the purposes of God, just the way my mind works, are intriguing. The redemption of human beings is not a return to the garden. The redemption of human beings is towards life in the city. So we begin in Genesis with a garden, and we end up at the very end in Revelation, the book of Revelation, with the city of God, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And listen to some of the descriptions of it. I'm not going to spend any time on it, but because we don't have it, but John describes it in terms of its length, in terms of the height of its walls, in terms of the shape of the streets and so on. And then he describes in it a tree whose leaves were for the healing of the nations. And he describes a river running through the middle of it. Now, what are they? If not, the image is casting us right back to the very beginning in Genesis. The story, the images of Eden all over again, only this time, the Garden of Eden is encompassed by the walls and the streets of the city. Now, what's going on there? We could spend, I guess, the rest of our time here thinking about why we're not going back to the Garden of Eden. Why are we going to the New Jerusalem? And the story, I think, of why that is a fascinating one. But what I want us to think about is this idea of the urban, of the New Jerusalem. I'm going to give you out. I didn't format these at all last night. I just stuck them down onto a sheet and printed them out. So apologies for the fact that they're not the best looking piece of work you ever saw. Forget about the front page. Forget also about the second page. But go to the very last page that's there. Don't read it just yet. If there was such a thing as a Christian city, what would it look like? Don't read those texts which are in front of you. What would the Christian city look like?
Not a rhetorical question, but looking for answers.
What would it be like? What would it be like to live in a Christian city?
There'd be lots of people there.
Lots of people.
And there'd be traffic jams on Sunday morning.
No,
because we wouldn't be going to church, is there?
Yeah.
Don't go to the temple in the center of the city. Yes, okay. Lots of people. Okay.
No police.
No police.
Or locks and keys.
There's how many city?
Or locks and keys.
Or
locks and keys.
No locks or keys.
Great.
Anything else?
What about harmony?
Pardon?
Or harmony.
Harmony.
Good.
Keep going.
Trees and rivers.
Pardon?
Trees and rivers.
Trees and rivers. Good. Great architecture. Tony Carnes and McDonald's and further on out past Newton Arts. Because it was more important to get the wealthy people into the places of wealth generation. So we will drive it. I saw a place once in which there was a city like that, and I drove along this road. It was a ring road that rings the city until you got here, and then it went, and then it came back out. And we were coming on, the guy who lived in the city said, "Have you noticed what's happening with this ring road?" And I said, "Yes, it's been, you know, this kind of straight big racetrack, and suddenly here." He said, "Well, look out to the left hand side, and here there were playing fields. And what was here was the largest, wealthiest Jesuit private school in the city. And here, across the tracks, was the poorest community of the city. And when the city were planning and designing the road, the intention was that it would cut right through the plain, through to this Jesuit college. And but of course, all the politicians, a lot of the politicians and a lot of the wealthy business people from the school running the city decided, hey, listen, hang on a minute, they're not driving through our playing fields, driving through there." And a whole community was destroyed because the powerful in the city could do it. And there wasn't a word in the churches. Not a word in people's faces about being just. Because that's how cities work. And if we're only concerned with making sure they're citizens, we have no concern about how the city works and the injustices that can happen as the powerful exercise power. This law doesn't work. This doesn't work for our cities because it's too naive. Because it doesn't deal with the reality of human sin and the fact that we cannot usher in the kingdom of God by the activities of human beings alone. And therefore, I think there needs to be some middle way of how we live in the city and how we as the church take the city. So, what you've got in front of you are visions of urban life on the back page in two prophets. And they've just been, I've chosen those deliberately and specifically. But the question we need to ask ourselves now is, give me a vision from these prophets of a Christian city, of a heavenly city. Let's look at the prophet Isaiah in 65. Isaiah 65. Take a moment to read through that text, and then let's begin to describe what this heavenly city is like. Where do you see that there?
Where it says, let me try verse 9. Yes, there it is. Yes, perfect. Yeah, the infant who lives but for a few days, but he old who does not live as
he dies. He dies of a humble thought of their youth. He who fails to reach a humble youth is considered a curse. It's poetic language. And we need, as we read the scriptures, let's begin to think, what is our contemporary analogue, if you like, for that idea, that image that's there? And he's talking about a city in which there is adequate healthcare from birth to death.
Anything else in the city?
Good housing.
Good housing, read it out to
me. They were both houses and dwellings in the farm vineyard near the fruits. No longer were made those houses, the latter shall be.
What does that mean? What does it mean to say it's, so it's good housing, but there's this other little thing? They would build their houses and they would live in them. No longer, where is it? No longer would they build houses and others live in them or plant and others eat. What's that mean?
Everybody will be equal.
Pardon?
Everybody will be equal and they have to afford.
Yeah, everybody can afford their housing. There will, but is it not saying something about.
You realise your dreams?
Mm-hmm. I think there's
something there about the economics of wealthy people being able to buy off property and rent it out. Something about workers making building houses that it's impossible for them to have a mortgage for. There's a relationship here between those who actually labour to bring this about and the economics that deprives them of actually enjoying the benefits of it.
There's
a justification on renting here.
Completely.
On the buying houses to rent out. Yes, strong.
There's a relationship between the work you put into something and the reward you get. That may be to do with dreams, you know, but there's something to do with exploitation here. I'm not going to use you to build so that I prosper. So there's a denial of exploitation here. There's a relationship between my work and my reward for my work. There is something to do with rent, how my work goes to, you know, line the pockets of somebody else. So there's something to do with the economic system of the city here. In Isaiah's vision. What else?
They enjoyed the environment.
Environment. Read it out, Arthur. What's it?
They plant vineyards and eat their fruit.
Yeah,
31.
And that's also to do with work. That you again this relationship between what I do and what I earn or what the return I get from the work. But there is something to do, yes, about enjoying the environment. What about the first couple of verses here? The sound of weeping and crying will be heard no more. But glad and rejoicing. Jerusalem will be a delight, its people a joy.
Seems less concrete to me than some of those things, and yet vital. The loss of joy in our community is something I'm becoming very aware of now. Is it an umbrella that goes over these kind of specifics, or
I wonder is it something to do with public celebrations and festivals? I wonder as Isaiah got a vision here. For the way, because earlier on in the book of Isaiah, he has a lot of criticism for the celebrations that happened round about the completion. Remember, they built a tunnel to get the water in underneath the walls, and they had a big celebration after that. And Isaiah prophesies over it that you're rejoicing now because you think the city's secure, but I can see the city falling and destroyed, and people, the walls being. And I wonder if there's something to do with legitimate celebration. I mean, think about. Well, just ask yourself, what would a Christian or a biblical public festival look like? Would it be the Orange Man? Or would it be, you know, what would it be like? If the people of a city were out on the streets, a joy and a celebration and rejoicing. Let's move on, so we haven't got much time. What's he saying in 58? Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins, raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with blight. When God gets his hands on the city, this is what he's going to do. And what is it?
Restoration. That's where you make your investment and kind of restoring something.
Restoring what though?
community that comes from, you know, streets of dwellings. Pictures in my mind, just the sense of community that have been decimated by, you know, the way in which the urban farmers have designed areas.
And it turned formerly inhabited streets into commercial and retail streets. So there are no longer, now you look at anything, what we've got now is housing takes place off the main arterial routes. The main arterial routes are now retail and commercial, and the houses are all pushed at the back. Now there's good to that, but there is a balance between streets, restorative streets with dwellings that our streets aren't deserted. So they become threatening places, dangerous places. But our streets are, there's a bit more of that a little bit later.
Of good relationships and that whole message about the neighbours and the defences, that there are people there who are taking care and responsibility for each other and for their environment, and that was important.
And I think there is a useful for restoring hope, and you know, I think that works on both a metaphorical kind of level, but there is a very concrete connection between the state of the built environment and people's sense of hope. And so it's not insignificant for me that we've got images here of rebuilding, of repairing and restoring, so that in this city there should be no dereliction. Because dereliction, people get used to a cycle of decline. We do that in our churches. As our numbers decline, we just get used to that, and everything declines. Our health, our mental state, our spirituality. The best example that I can remember of that is I was on the Dart in Dublin the day it started, and I remember it all the run up to that and all the promises. And one of the promises that I never forgot from the government was if we build a quality light rail service and we maintain it well, that it will not be vandalised. And by and large, the Dart system has done pretty well, the trains have done pretty well. But they haven't got like the old trains that they used to travel on as well before the Dart came in, which were awful. Like our old rail system. The newer trains are kept there. We reduce the cycle of dereliction and we restore a measure of hope to the people in those communities. So it seems entirely logical to me that the prophets not only make a connection between people's sense of hope and the state of their physical environment, but these two things are connected.
Isaiah 65 is a kind of reference to that verse.
Yes.
Our toil and pain, our very children being misfortune. The notion that the environment is degenerative, that there is an environmental decay that results in generational decay. That idea of toil and pain, where something becomes so dysfunctional that you work and you work and you work, and it seems impossible to actually improve one's lot to the point where there is generational, a loss of aspiration, generational.
Yeah.
Yes.
And working in the inner city, that you see that all around you every day.
I think one of the things you see alongside of it, and it's something that challenged my classes to you that I had things, because I just was at Workman Avenue and I was just struck with the way in which somebody had put shutters up on the outside of their building, and they had a big white Victorian lamp in the garden, and they had a wee statue of Eros. And in me, I'm going, oh my glory, that's just kitsch. And I was struck with my own judgment. And yet when I looked at it alongside all the others, it actually was a little beacon of hope that was about investing and making a house nice and being an alternative statement. When I went back, you know, a number of months later, another house had done something. And while it looked like it was keeping up with the Joneses, it wasn't. But I would think it was that. And without actually going and knocking the door and asking, what have you got back in the garden? But there was a little glimmer of just, I'm not dealing with this cycle of decline, and I actually put something back, and it has to be a little more obvious and more. But it just made me think, I actually was reading it as kitsch, and maybe it was something else.
So reaching out, I think.
Yeah, because especially in the last year, I'm there in the streets around about.
there's so many that are just shut off and
And the presence of, you know, restorers of streets with dwellings and so on, this idea, one of the big moves in the city at the minute, some of us are, is to try in some of those inner city areas, is to campaign to get the shops to remove the shutters. If you drive down Newton Arch Road after 6 o'clock any night, winter or summer, and you are faced with lines of shuttered shop fronts, and it's awful. It's just awful. And one of the signs of a community being restored is the removal of those shutters, even if they're nicely painted like the ones we have at the mission. Really, you know, removing them, the sense that people are secure, their property secure, but also the sense that behind these doors and windows are like the stores or streets and dwellings. Anyway, let's keep pushing on. 10 minutes, have we, Linda?
But that demands a lot of trust, doesn't it? And I was struck by the wolf and the lamb will feed together.
Yes, yes, yes. Faith, I think it's good. It's okay. We sometimes kind of toy with that word, don't we? Faith. Not really sure what it means in our context, but it does. It's a risk. It's a risk. But it can be a risk. A foolish statement of hope that this place can be restored. What about that Isaiah 60? What vision does he have? This is slightly different, I think. This is the very end of Isaiah, where Isaiah has taken the vision of Jerusalem away from, if we repent, Jerusalem will be saved, and it's not, it's destroyed. Well, then Isaiah says, well, after a certain number of years, we all come back to Jerusalem, and we will restore the glory of Jerusalem, and you know what? They all go back, and they kind of, it's pathetic what they rebuild. And Jeremiah takes the vision of Jerusalem again, or Isaiah, the vision of Jerusalem again, takes it not from save it, not from restore it, but actually, do you know what? It's way off up here in the future. It's an eschatological vision, is the theological term. But here's a key part of his eschatological vision for the New Jerusalem. What's he saying in this, in all this poetic language?
There is something intrinsically life and something further about the very being of the city that people are flocking to it. They are rushing to it. They're waiting to it. They can't wait to get there. You know, the kings are rushing, the ships and torches are rushing, the nations are flocking. It's all happening. Because it's permeated by the essence of God and you know what is good and true and right.
People will flock to your life. They flock to your life. It's a great vision.
Comes up the fact that children are coming back home.
Yeah.
After leaving because there are no jobs, after leaving because of the sectarian conflict, after leaving, you know, the children come back home, the sons and daughters.
What about trade? The international reach of the city, you know, and herds of camels, sheep will come bearing gold and incense proclaiming the praise of the Lord. Kedar's flocks will be gathered, the rams, and so on. And these ships of Tarshish bringing your stuff from afar, silver and gold. The fact that here's a city with an international reach, and there's trade and prosperity for, you know, enough to sustain our children. That's part and parcel of it. Is there also something in there? And this one is interesting too, in the light of things like the story of Babel, and about ethnic diversity in this city. Foreigners will rebuild your walls.
Polish, Lithuanian, Polish.
Your gates will always stand open. They will never be shut day or night, so that men may bring you the wealth of the nations. Here is a welcoming city to all the nations of the world. There isn't any news that said there would be no racism and no sectarianism, but instead a city that throws open its gates to those who want to come and work here and live here and make their. Lastly, the vision of Zechariah. Zechariah and Isaiah are related on these things, but have a read through that. Do you know, there is something. There is something spiritual in the vision older people have. Do you remember the days we used to play football on the street? Or the loss of the skipping games and the rhymes and stuff like that. There is something spiritual that has been lost with that. And maybe it is the iPod generation. Maybe it is, it's not, it's community, I don't know. But in this, the vision of the city here is streets filled with boys and girls playing. We're not talking here about, as I said, flocks and flocks of people making traffic jams on Sunday morning. You know, and everybody involved in worship and everybody. We're talking about kids playing on the street. That's a spiritual vision. And to the extent that we can store that in the areas around about where we live and worship, is the extent to which we are bringing the vision of the kingdom in our place. Anything else on this?
Well, I was going to play safety.
Yeah.
You know, playing football on the street where I live, they're constantly having to stop for it's all going fast.
Now, and you hold on to that one.
And the men, the old men, I mean, the street, that's community as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Great. Great vision. Anything else? Integrity in the city, there's truth in the city. Well, look, the reason we could spend a lot more time, just to kind of wrap this up as we go and walk the streets of the city today, I think we need to notice the way the city's being built and the way the city's changing. I learned a couple of weeks ago that in the year 2000, the city of Shanghai was a kind of big city, but it was fairly, you know, I don't know if you've seen any pictures of Shanghai recently. It is an incredible city, and in 2005, they had 25% of the world's cranes in the one city. 25% of the world's cranes in Shanghai. Now, Belfast, so fair share. Look at the ways, you know, we need to know, because we need to know how the city's changing and growing and developing. And because we have a much bigger responsibility than just providing citizens for the city. But the reason we looked at this vision that the prophets have in their poetic language is because recognizing we can't do this ourselves. Recognizing that we don't just huddle away and provide citizens. We have a responsibility to be fired by a vision for how a city should work, for what should characterize a good city, a proper, God-blessed, graced city. And then, to be fired by that vision, recognizing that it may be set way, way in the future, but we then start today, fired by that vision, to try and make dimensions of that real in our own context, round about where we live. So therefore, dereliction round your church is a spiritual consideration. It is a spiritual matter that we should be concerned, and much of saving souls, we need to be concerned about their religion. We need to be concerned about safety on our roads, about street lighting. We need to be concerned about the fact that our children are being driven away by the economics. We need to be concerned about the housing people living. These are every bit as legitimate as the preaching of the gospel. Let me ask you some questions. I would love the first time to think these through, but I'm just going to fire them out to you now as questions which I think are all spiritual responsibilities of the church. We should have theologically argued opinions and answers. In the redeemed city, would we notice a difference in how people treated one another when they passed on the street? In the redeemed city, what would traffic patterns be like on Sunday? What about litter? Would we need jails? What would police officers do? What about the legal profession? In the Redeemed City, what about pastors? Would there be a rise or a fall in investment in social services? In the Redeemed City, what would be the balance between roads and paths, pathways? Where would the priority lie in traffic and public transport? What about street lighting? What would our public spaces and parks look like in the Redeemed City? Would we spend more time or less time at work? What about the balance between detached, semi-detached, terraced and apartment homes? What about the mix of private, public and affordable housing? What would our public celebrations look like? What would be the impact on the arts? Would there be fewer or more out-of-town shopping malls? Because actually these are all spiritual questions. And just on that last one, which I have a particular opinion on, but why is it that the cheapest shopping, or how have we allowed it to be the case that the cheapest goods are only available to those who have their own transport? Now, if that's not an issue of social justice, I don't know what it is. But the shops that continue to exist within walking distance of people's homes are the most expensive. Therefore, by our shopping patterns, we are actually disadvantaged. It's disadvantaging the poor. So I think the Heavenly City would have a very strong opinion of shopping mall, out-of-town shopping mall. To balance, I think, these kinds of things, to have answers to these kinds of things, we need to recognise that our lives in the city, whether that's a city like this, whether it's a regional town or whatever, that the way we live in these spaces has what one theologian calls eschatological importance. We live today in these spaces, we should be living today in these spaces with a view to the Heavenly City. We live today in the way we want this city to work and operate, and the way it will in God's timing. To recognise that it's not going to come about just because of me, that it is ultimately, as Jesus said to Nicodemus, this thing will only be born from above. It's the gift of God. And we are to live in ways that continually witness to the future, to what the city will become. That involves, just, and I'm only going to mention them, I'm not going to elaborate on them. Firstly, that we need to do some negative things, and that is point out what is wrong in the city. But we also need to do some transformative things, some positive things, by taking a vision like this of the city as it should be and allowing it to shape our understanding of how life should be and how the earthly city should look. And then work for the vision of the heavenly city in the midst of the earthly city. Do you see what I mean? We live and work today in the city the way we want the heavenly city to be. And we shouldn't just be testifying to the hope of that, but actually living for it today. So we have again those two dimensions, those two sides.